Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Reminder that we Zoom on Thursday morning, so we're not going to be talking about Joe Biden's speech on Thursday night.
It's the big event.
It is the big event. You can hear the voice of Scott Braddock. Mm-hmm. Anyway, before we get to Scott, before we toss to Scott Braddock from Texas, we, of course, remind you that we begin every show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. He's a testimony to patriotism. He's a testimony to someone with a spine who's willing to talk truth to power. He's a testimony to why immigration policy is so important in this country, because it brings us people like Colonel Vindman. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is in the fall of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. Oh, yes.
Well, it wasn't last week. I apologize. I got to level with the listeners because I know you count on my insights every week here.
I do.
I know it's really difficult to get through a week without hearing about all the BS going on in Texas. But last week, I needed to just not think so hard.
I know.
Every once in a while, you need a break, right?
No, I totally. Well, look,
My thinker works better if it gets a break now and then. So I'm ready to go.
We truly missed you, and you know we replaced you.
I missed you.
We replaced you with John Nichols.
John's about it.
Yeah, so yeah,
he's all right.
But it wasn't. He's all right.
It's a different flavor. It's a different flavor of thinking.
It's a different flavor. It wasn't Texas. So anyway, he's the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And the reason why we so love talking to Scott Braddock is because as Texas goes, truly, so goes the nation. The Democratic National Convention has been so interesting, and I would love to get your take on it. Everybody was sort of on pins and needles. How are they going to pull it off? Yada, yada, yada. Will we pay attention? It truly has been quite effective, much more effective than the conventions. So I have been to lots of conventions,
and
I love the atmosphere, and I love the
connection. You're a veteran of this stuff.
Right. But this was not just made for TV.
Mm-hmm.
It was made for teaching and learning and paying attention and being engaged. I mean, you got sort of sucked into the storyline because they truly did tell a story of America. And I think we don't always get to sort of see and hear that story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really a lot of what that convention was able to do.
Yeah, I think it's a little more focused. When you have a convention hall that is filled with people and you're also televising the thing, you have two audiences, right? You have the people who are there, in person, and then you have the people who are watching on TV. And so the presentations have to be done for both of those audiences.
Right.
And in this instance, they are only tailoring it for you at home. And Arnie, you're a veteran broadcaster, and so you get what I'm about to say. And actually, earlier in the week, I was talking about this on the Chad Hasty radio show out in Lubbock, Texas, one of my very conservative friends. And, the fact is, and I remember this as a disc jockey at 16 years old, and the owner of the radio station in Brenham, Texas, KWHI, Friendly Country, he said to me, you got to remember that when you're speaking on the radio, it's not like when you're talking to, the whole classroom and you're giving a book report or, you're talking to a hall full of people. When you're talking on the radio, you're talking to one person at a time. They're in their car or they're in their home or whatever, and you have to connect with that person. And a mentor of mine later on in Houston took that a step further and said, Scott, you have to pop out of the radio. People have to remember what you said. I was doing my radio reports at KTRH 740 AM in Houston, Texas, and I was so excited. And that was about when I was 23, 24 years old. And I'm doing my rap out there about whatever on the streets of Houston. And they sent me to everything that was, you know, a shooting or a fire or whatever. There's always something like that in Houston, Texas. So I remember I had done my report and I was talking to my news director later. And he says, dude, and he would talk, dude, he would call me dude. He called everybody dude. He'd say, dude, why aren't you talking about this part of it? And this part of whatever story. And I said, no, it's right here in my script. I did talk about that. And he goes, Scott, if I didn't hear it, then you didn't say it.
Right.
So what's happening in this DNC convention that is tailored for the person at home is they're making sure you hear everything they say.
They do.
And the people who are on, quote unquote, on stage, it's the only thing at that moment. There is no crowd to distract. And so when I watched the beginning of this, and we'll get into it more in a little bit, but you know, there was all this talk in Texas about what, you know, whether they were sort of dissing Texas by not having Texans there. They didn't have Texas politicians there.
Exactly.
But let me tell you something. The first night, and especially the first 30 minutes and really the first hour of the DNC on Monday night, was all Texas. Eva Longoria is probably the best known Texan who's involved in this event. And she was the host for the whole thing on Monday night, right? Ninth generation Texan, born in Corpus Christi, spent most of her life in San Antonio. She's moved out to Hollywood now. She's maybe forgotten about, you know, us little people back here now. But people know her not only for being, you know, an actress, but they also know that she has done a lot of activism in the Democratic Party, trying to get Latinos to vote. In fact, she founded a group based on that. You didn't just have Eva Longoria. You had real Texans. You had a school nurse from El Paso, Texas, who was talking about just the need to have the kids wash their hands, socially distance, put on the mask, and all that sort of stuff. She was talking about the challenges of bringing kids back to school during a pandemic. That's real Texas, right? Then they went live to Houston, Texas, where the family of George Floyd talked about the loss of their brother and about this moment in our country that we're seeing. You know, so much emotion wrapped up around, you know, what happened in the wake of the death of George Floyd, which, you know, right after that, Republicans and Democrats alike all said, that's terrible. That should not have happened. We have to do something about this. Now, of course, partisan structure has, you know, come into the discussion, you know, and we'll talk about this again here in a little bit about what the responses are in the wake of that.
Oh, yeah.
In the Black Lives Matter versus defunding the police, all this sort of stuff. But I thought it was very effective, and there's a real chance for something like this to be completely forgettable. I will say that unlike the Texas Democratic Party's online convention, I thought there were a lot of memorable moments from the DNC so far. You know, the first two nights, maybe not as much, but getting into what Barack Obama had to say, and Republicans and Democrats would agree, still the most effective speaker on earth is Barack Hussein Obama. I don't think anybody would argue with that. You know, they may not agree with exactly everything he's saying, but then you have, you know, the presentation of Kamala Harris and all of these different moments throughout the DNC. I think it's been very effective, Arnie, but the thing is, it's just a different kind of presentation. And after the business of the political parties stopped being what they do at the conventions, this is where it's always been going anyway, right? It's a bunch of videos and speeches and, you know, it's not the backroom deals anymore. It's really just a 4 or 5 day commercial for the Democratic or Republican parties. And so they're getting to just do that. And, you know, they've got some of the best people in the world working on this, and we'll see what the Republicans roll out as well.
So that's one of the reasons I've always loved doing radio. I remember when I did morning drive time for a long time.
Yeah.
And we had actually had a bumper sticker that said, "Stuck in the car with Arnie." And it really was. It was, and that was about meant that it was just you and me.
Right.
You know, that was it. You were driving into Boston, and you were listening to me, and you were stuck with me.
Yeah,
I was your partner, and I was your wife, and I was sitting on the car with you.
When you watched the rollout of Kamala Harris as the VP pick, which they did, what was that, a week ago? And they did it to an empty hall there. They gave their speeches, Biden and she did. You could tell that the speechwriters working on that were still working under the mindset and sort of the framework of a speech where there's a crowd in front of them. Because you could hear the lines just, so they're expecting people to applaud, and there's nobody there to do that. And I think there's still a little bit of that in some of the speeches that I heard so far in the DNC, but not much of it. It was interesting that you had, again, some Texans who were involved in that keynote of sort of the young Democrats from around the country. There were two legislators from North Texas, Victoria Neave, who's a friend of mine. She's a Democratic representative from Dallas County. And the new congressman, freshman congressman from Dallas, Colin Allred, both in that. And, you know, I thought for the people who are watching that, and here's another thing that we should say about it. It's more about the audience than it's about the individual people who are speaking, right? Because the audience gets to see this aggregation of people from all over the country. This is the new face of the Democratic Party. Here's a very diverse field of people. You know, they would have the people either one at a time on screen, or they'd have, you know, 50 people all at once, and you could see how diverse the faces are. That's about me taking a look at the party. That's not about the person who's speaking just getting to say what they came to say. And so in a lot of ways, I think that's more effective way, a more effective way to reach the audience. And, you know, it's very, I'll say it this way, it's very chattering class of us and of the Texas Democratic Party to be so upset that, you know, there weren't more Texas politicians on stage. I mean, Beto was involved, but if you blinked, you missed him. He was just in one of those montages. And, you know, MJ Hager is running against John Cornyn this year. And, you know, a lot of Democrats are excited about that race. And I did hear a lot of grumbling from Democrats. Like, why isn't she featured at the Democratic National Convention? Well, it wouldn't be bad for her to be, but that would be about her. That wouldn't be about the audience who's watching. Giving. And as these elections have become more and more nationalized, I don't think it's bad to be less candidate specific and more specific about who you are as a party and what it is you hope to accomplish and what you will actually do for people. I think this presentation makes it more about the voter than about the politicians.
So I just sent this out. I'm not sure I've sent it out to you, but I tweeted this out this morning. So at about 3 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and it hit me. Of course, this is how Arnie. I'm sort of processing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night. So I never sleep. At least my mind never does. And so I tweeted this out last night. I said, last night it hit me. African slaves built this country. Mm-hmm. Now Black African Americans are tasked with saving it. It was like a moment where I literally sat up in bed. And in part, it was because I'd heard Michelle that first night, and then I heard Barack, and then I heard Kamala, and then I saw this diversity, and I saw America in a way that I know it, but I didn't quite ever see it. And that was the other thing, was that it wasn't just about people with this diverse quilt of America, but you got to see the quilt of this country. You got to see Black Angus cows or whatever they were, and you got to see people up in Alaska. So you got to see the visual of who we are.
I had no idea the backdrop of who we are,
as well as the diversity of the people who we are. And I'm just looking at this and I'm thinking, what a beautiful bouquet. It's a bouquet. And that's really what they were celebrating. And yet at the same time, as I'm listening to the most powerful speakers, it was these three Black Americans. And I realized they are tasked with saving us. And that's what each one of those three kind of told us. And I saw their leadership and I saw their vision and I was grateful.
The other thing that we should point out here is that there are a surprising amount of Republican voices at the Democratic National Convention. And that, of course, is controversial within the Democratic Party. I have heard from a lot of very progressive Texans, liberal Texans, who said that they did not like that, especially when, you know, they were looking forward to hearing from people like Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro, maybe people like that. And instead, they're listening to John Kasich. Well, you know, and I don't know what genius
decided. And
John
McCain.
I don't know what genius decided that it was a great idea to literally put Kasich at a fork in the road while he talked about a fork in the road for the country. It's kind of silly, but I do think that it makes some difference in some of these states where the votes, you know, came down to just, you know, tens of thousands of people across three states, right? When you look at what difference was made in the presidential election, you've got a couple of things going for the Democrats right now. Number one, they did nominate the guy from Scranton, Pennsylvania, who can speak the same language as the people who did what? Voted for Obama and Trump. Right. In Texas, I've never met anyone who voted for both Obama and Trump. But when you're trading votes in the Sun Belt in Texas for votes in the Rust Belt, which is what President Trump did, and he finished way behind other Republican nominees in Texas because he was preaching a message that was anti the Texas economy. Right. I mean, Texas is optimized for globalization. You know, we are a big trading partner with Mexico. Right. We're an oil and gas state. We rely on an elastic workforce because of, you know, thanks to the immigration from Mexico, that we need a more robust system of immigration, not a less robust one. We don't need a wall. That's the worst thing for us. What we need is a seawall along the Gulf Coast because we get hurricanes.
Yes.
We need a different kind. We need
a different kind of wall.
A different kind of wall, but free trade, immigration, those sorts of things are the things that are good for Texas. But the states in the industrial Midwest, their economies are not set up for that. Now, a president who is looking toward the future would be helping those states set themselves up for that. But instead, what he's doing is he's saying, you can have everything back that you had before, right? What President Trump is doing, and this is the short redneck version of it for me, when you trade votes in the Sun Belt for votes in the Rust Belt, you're voting on the past instead of the future. And that's what Make America Great Again is all about. It's about that we can go back to the way it was before, when everyone knows that you're not going to go back. And then, of course, to sabotage himself, the president went after Goodyear just this week, which has that's his whole strategy, is to wrap those folks in a warm blanket and say, we're going to bring your manufacturing jobs back. And then he badmouths Goodyear, which has tens of thousands of employees, I think, in Ohio. I know they have at least 67,000 employees, something like that, spread across states. Most of that in the industrial Midwest. So you do have a presidential nominee in Biden who can compete in those places, right? In Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and won't take them for granted.
And so it also reflects Joe Biden. Joe Biden talks a lot about bipartisanship.
Yeah.
Is it too much? Well, I'm listening to the Democrats in my state. They talk ad nauseum about bipartisanship. Mm-hmm. If I hear from Jean Shaheen, every other word out of her mouth on the advertisements is bipartisanship. So let me just sort of refresh everyone's recollection. I am 66 years old. I started in politics in New Hampshire in my late 20s. And I was invited into the electoral process and into running for the state house by the Republican majority leader. Can I repeat that? Yeah. Liberal, progressive, lefty Arnie, you know, happened to get to know the Republican majority leader, and he admired me. He didn't agree with me, everyone. Right. He admired me, and it was worth it to him to risk inviting me in to think about running for the legislature because he wanted my talent. He wanted my thoughtfulness. Even though he knew that there'd be times we would be on the opposite side of each other. Right. There was a moment where that was possible. And Joe Biden remembers that moment. John McCain represented that moment. Yeah. In a lot of ways, John Kasich is an old friend of mine, and so is John McCain. That's what's so amazing. Both men, if McCain was still alive, you would ask John McCain, do you know Arnie Arneson? John would go, oh, I love her. Ask John Kasich, do you know Arnie Arneson? John Kasich will go, oh my God, do I know Arnie? Now you're going to ask the question, how is that possible? But it is possible. So in a lot of ways, he wasn't saying, I want to become Republicans. I agree with them. What he says is that there are times we can find common ground. And what is more important, Scott, more important than our partisanship is our country. And yeah, that's where we find consensus.
One of the things I'm really worried about heading into the next legislative session here in Texas is, and you know, we have that same tradition here of being bipartisan. We're one of the, and you don't even do this in New Hampshire, I don't think. One of the things that we do is that no matter who is holding the gavel in the Texas House, whether the speaker is a Democrat or a Republican, we have a long history of having a mix of Democratic and Republican chairmen in important committees, not just token committees like the tourism committee or, you know, the committee that oversees the gift shop. You know, you don't just give that to the minority party. You know, big committees are run right now by Democrats in Texas, including Public Health Committee, Transportation Committee, et cetera.
That's remarkable.
And we have a long tradition of that. And one thing that is concerning as we look at the planning for the next legislative session is that the members, and this goes to what you're talking about, Arnie, and it goes to what Joe Biden's experience is in the U.S. Senate when he was there. And when you think about Biden as a senator, he was a senator how long ago? More than a decade ago? I mean, he was a senator 15, 20 years ago, right? He's from that era.
Well, he started even longer than that.
There's a story in New York Times this morning about how I rewrote the headline, but it was something like, you know, there's a lot of Democrats who are worried about just how damn bipartisan this man is. He's always trying to get along with Republicans, and current Democrats, a lot of them and a lot of new Democrats, don't understand what you're talking about, where you can commiserate with Republicans and they're not alien. You know, they don't unzip and it's a snake underneath at night. It's another person. Right.
Exactly.
But as they start to plan the next legislative session, what occurs to me is Democrats and Republicans, because we're in a pandemic and because there has to be social distancing and because they won't spend as much time together on the actual floor of the Texas House, they won't be visiting the way that they normally do. They won't be standing around talking about, you know, during the downtimes, they won't be sitting around, you know, talking about their kids and talking about what movie they just saw.
Sharing barbecue recipes.
And saying, hey, why don't you come to the ranch in East Texas sometime and we'll all sit around and, you know, drink beer and shoot the breeze and that sort of stuff, which they do. Republicans and Democrats do that. And if they don't, when you don't know the person, it's easier to dehumanize the person during a political debate, right? That they're evil somehow, because you don't know the person. And I'm worried about that sort of.
So let me just
That sort of getting along not happening.
I want to put a button on this conversation because I want to get into some of the things, the topics that you sent me. But before we do that, I just want to say something. There is a skill set that Joe Biden is bringing to the table. And this bipartisanship, I'm going to apply to the Democratic Party, because it's going to be a fight within the party. You've got the sort of the more progressive wing, you've got the new Democratic wing, and really what he has to do is find the common ground within his own party. This isn't about crossing party lines. This is about looking at the sort of the AOCs and the Clinton types within his own party. And I think what he talks about when you think of Republicans and Democrats is actually a skill set that he's going to bring to the Democratic Party, because there is this real arc of difference between different wings of the party. And I think that that might be useful. But I got to talk about this. This is just shocking. You sent me a note that Governor Abbott threatened cities, saying those that cut police budgets will see their property tax revenue frozen. What the H is this about? What happened to local control? I mean, come on.
Local control is over. I hear people all the time say, well, Republicans only believe in local control when it's convenient. I am trying to remember the last time Republicans in Texas supported local control at all. I think it has to go back to the Rick Perry administration. Governor Abbott, one of his very first speeches that he gave as the newly elected governor, was at, you know, in front of a group called the Texas Public Policy Foundation, where he essentially said cities and counties in Texas should not even be able to have ordinance making authority. They shouldn't be able to make their own rules for anything. He even took aim at cities being able to set their own tree pruning ordinances.
Oh my God.
So all the way down, we're going to micromanage Texas out of Austin. So while you have George Floyd's family speaking at the DNC about what has happened in the wake of their brother's death, the answer from the leadership in Texas is that we are going to stand with the police no matter what. Now, this is what I meant earlier when I said that, you know, there was a lot of bipartisan agreement that something could be done about reforming, you know, police right after that tragedy. But of course, now things are breaking down along partisan lines. You had the Austin City Council. And by the way, anytime that Republican leadership in Texas is just about out of good arguments, they can always count on the Austin City Council to bail them out and give them something to disagree with. Austin, just this past week, voted to, quote, defund police. But what they actually did, and I'm reading the details here from the Austin American-Statesman, so we know what we're talking about.
Yes, sir.
The Austin City Council voted to shift $150 million from the Austin Police Department's proposed $434 million annual budget. And these big cities have huge police budgets, right? I mean, in New York and Los Angeles, they're billions of dollars for their police departments. What this means, though, is not that they are getting rid of public safety. The small slice of this, $21 million, is going to immediately cut from the police department budget. They're canceling three upcoming cadet classes, slashing some overtime costs by about $3 million and a few other steps. But $128 million is just being diverted into other public safety measures for the city of Austin. So it's not like we're saying, okay, we're not going to do public safety around here. Well, after they did that, the governor goes to Fort Worth and points out that in a press conference this week, he pointed out that Austin was number one in a Wall Street Journal study that ranked cities for violent crime. Never mind the fact that he was speaking in Fort Worth, which was number three on the list. He didn't mention that. But what he said was that we are going to stand against any cities that want to defund the police. And so what Texas leadership wants to do is, once again, meddle in the budgets of cities and counties, in this case with cities. And he said that if they cut their police budget at all, and he left this vague, if they cut their police budget at all, it will be state law that they can't raise their property tax revenue year over year. I mean, okay, we're going to once again cap the local governments for what they can do. Well, some conservative groups immediately came out and said this is a ridiculous idea from the government from the governor, because this would incentivize cities to maybe cut their police budget by $1, so that then property taxes would be frozen for all of their taxpayers. Mm-hmm. In other words, that would make the mayor pretty popular. Hey, I just froze your property taxes. So they'll have to figure out the details on this. But look, I think that it breaks down along these partisan lines, because this is going to be another skin of your teeth election for Texas Republicans. In 2018, remember, statewide, you had elected officials, including Ted Cruz, Governor Abbott, and Abbott outperformed the others, but the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, they all just won by 1 or 2 points
right
across the state. This year, the big prize is the Texas House. Can Democrats take the Texas House, take the majority? They're within 9 votes of doing that. And if you poll defunding the police, and we know that internal polling is showing Republicans this, if you poll that in rural Texas or in the suburbs, you know, out in the country, it's like 90-10 against defunding the police, if that's what the message is, right? In the suburbs, you can fight them to a draw about this, basically. That you're going to have probably 70-30 against defunding the police, if that's the argument. Some national groups are already running ads in suburban Texas, in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston. You know, the same ads you've seen nationally where, you know, a little old lady is calling the police and someone's breaking into the house.
And it's going,
but we'll send you over to the sensitivity department. And, yes, we're backed up to Friday and we can send you there.
Yeah.
Trying to scare people about this. And it is a scare tactic. It doesn't have a basis in policy at all, because even what Austin did, and Austin, again, pretty liberal city, but what they did is not take away from public safety. But what they did do was say, we're going to reform the way our police department works. And so this is the gamble.
But it's still under the umbrella of protection. I want people to understand that there are different ways of protecting it. It isn't just with someone who happens to be wearing a uniform and carrying a gun. There are other ways of doing it, but protection is the goal.
To further the point, the new chairman of the Texas Republican Party, former Florida congressman, the Florida man, Alan West, has been doing interviews and speaking engagements in rural Texas, where he's telling Republicans that you have to turn out at least 75%. And this is the key. If Republicans can, in the rural parts of the state, turn out at a higher rate than they have previously, I mean, this is the last skin of the teeth election before the next redistricting cycle. And so what they're looking to do is, you know, to basically take the ringer out and just get every last vote out of rural Texas that they can, because that's the firewall. If you go back 2 or 3 cycles, it would be rural Texas voting at like 60-65% Republican voting strength. In the last election, it was closer to 70. And now they're just flat out saying to voters in rural Texas, we need you to turn out at 75%. So if they can turn them out at 75% and battle the Democrats to a draw in the suburbs, then President Trump can carry Texas by 5 or 6 points, something like that, and that's what they're looking to do.
And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. An amazing conversation, and what an education we get from you every Friday. Thank you so much for joining us,
Arnie. Thank you.
Shucks. All right, talk to you soon. Yeah, stay healthy. That's all I ask. And on that note, let's stick around, and when we come back, I believe his name is Stefan Schmidt. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll be right back.
Like I could somehow stop time. forgotten all the things I clearly did. The warm summer rays cooked our skin for days. We fell asleep under the shade. Oh Lord, we had it made. The earth will spin beneath your feet. Your shadow stretches down the street. Calendar pages fly. 10,000 crows will take the sky. The earth will spin beneath your feet. Your shadow stretches down the street. Calendar.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. He joins us every other week. He is known as Dr. Politics, a professor of political science at Iowa State, although I think he has retired after I don't know how many decades of teaching political science to probably all the most important political scientists in the country, because your textbook is the most used political science textbook in the United States. I just want people to know this. Stefan Schmidt joins us, and there is so much to talk about, Stefan. But again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Thursday morning, so we will not be able to comment on Joe Biden's comments tonight, but we will be able to comment on the first three nights of the Democratic Convention. We heard from Scott Braddock and he weighed in. We've been hearing from lots of different people about this, but I'm kind of curious, Stefan. I saw an article from Harold Meyerson. We Zoom the show on Thursday morning, so we'll not be able to talk about Joe Biden, but we can talk, Stefan, about the first three nights of the Democratic Convention. I'm going to tell you, I saw an interesting article by Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect. And he talked about the fact that what Barack Obama did on Wednesday night was really give his Gettysburg Address.
That was an interesting comment. I think you tweeted that out maybe, didn't you?
Yeah. Obviously, I was over the moon about Kamala. I mean, I have to tell you, I was over the moon. I was a reluctant sort of happy camper, like, okay, you know, do I really want her? And one of my big concerns about Kamala, can I be honest with you? This was my biggest concern. When Kamala decided to run for president, she actually had to make a choice. And this is what bothers me. Was she going to run as a more moderate or as a progressive liberal Democrat? Now, I hate to break it to you. You should not have that choice. You should either be one thing or the other. And you shouldn't think about how am I going to package myself, A or B. You kind of saw how she sort of evolved. She started out more progressive, then she became more moderate, and then she dropped out. Okay, so that was it. So I had this sort of sense of, do I really want this woman to be the vice presidential candidate? And then I heard her last night, and I have to tell you, if she could have hit every single key on the piano, she did. Because for me, I walked away saying, I am so glad she is there. And I admire at least the package she presented last night, because it truly was both inspirational And what I heard from her was a future of America that I want. So your thoughts.
I agree with you. And I would go back to your beginning of your comment, which is, you know, real politics is about compromise, and real politics, when you want to win and not just take a rigid position, is about evolving and, in a sense, tailoring what you're offering to what is needed at the time.
Yeah.
And the criticism of Bernie Sanders was, even though people loved a lot of his positions, is that he's very rigid. He doesn't like to compromise. And politics, Arnie, I'm sorry, it's about compromise. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of the young Democrats are terribly frustrated because you got a bunch of old people and middle of the roaders and people who want to reach out to Republicans running this thing. But, you know, if you want to be pure, you end up being a small minority party. And mm-hmm. I think Kamala Harris, basically was listening. She was listening to what voters in the various different primaries and caucuses were saying. And she's very flexible. She has been all her career. You know, we've had these wonderful new portraits of who is Kamala Harris? Who was she? You know, and she's evolved throughout her entire career. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with that. And I think, the one thing that, of course, didn't come across, because it shouldn't, in that speech that she gave, is that she is a real attack politician who knows how to slice and dice and make her opponents bleed. And this is where we are in America. Joe Biden is too much of a nice guy. And I know we're not talking about his speech because it will come another day. But, you know, Joe Biden is a nice guy. And this is a time when nice guys are liable to get beaten up. And they need somebody next to them, like Kamala Harris. Right. And I think that is a great asset for this ticket.
She was remarkable. We got a sense of her personality. We got a sense of her compassion. We got a sense of her intellect. She wasn't tough last night.
Right.
Because last night, she didn't need to be tough on us. We needed to trust her.
Yeah.
That's what last night was about. She built the bridge of trust. And she did it incredibly effectively. What she will now do with Mike Pence is something we will also see. But that's not what she needed to do with me. Okay. And again, this was, you heard Scott Braddock talk about the fact that this kind of format is very, very intimate. It's about a conversation with one person, not a conversation with a million people. And yet she was able to connect, I think, with a million people one-on-one. And that was really what she was able to do. And Barack Obama, you know, I was talking to one of my new law students who just moved in, and he said for the first 5 or 10 minutes, he wasn't quite sure that Barack was going to sort of nail it. And he said, you kind of almost watched this sort of intensity and rage grow within Barack, and he finally let it rip. So the last end of his speech was powerful and poignant and focused and making us realize that we're really on a precipice. And I think it was, in a way, interesting because we don't really see that level of intensity coming from him very often. Right. He almost runs away from it. I think he has that capacity, but he rarely shows it. And you had to actually watch him. Even at this moment, he had to get there because he couldn't start there.
Right. I mean, he's no drama Obama, right?
Exactly.
And so he finally found the drama.
Yeah, he did.
And he went after Trump directly, which is, apparently quite unprecedented for a former president to go against a sitting president directly and attack. And I think that shows you that the 2020 election is a much more vicious, brutal, difficult, and modern election. I think maybe others will be the same. By the way, the format, I think, is terrific. I don't think they're going to go back much to a huge convention with people with funny hats getting drunk and, you know, staying in hotels and expensive convention centers. Some of that might come back. But I'm in Rhode Island right now. Rhode Island's delegate gave his vote by touting the calamari, which is a favorite dish in Rhode Island. And I cannot tell you the impact that it made in terms of Rhode Islanders getting excited about this convention. You know, it brought it right home. And I can tell you the same about Iowa, because you had Vilsack and his wife, former governor, standing in front of a devastated cornfield and bringing directly to Iowans the reality that Democrats are in Iowa. They're not at a convention center in Milwaukee. They're in Iowa, talking about the Iowa problems and how Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the Democrats may bring different policies to the problems of Iowa. And I think that kind of really statewide and territorial intimacy is something that has never happened before.
They've knocked it out of the park. It's been it's been very effective. We all feel a sense of commonality. You heard Scott Braddock say that, you know, Texans were upset because Beto wasn't there, and it was like, and then you suddenly realized he was absolutely right. No, but Texas was.
Yeah.
It wasn't about big names. It was about Texans. It wasn't about people who are notorious or well-known. It was people you've never met before, because it was a nurse or it was the guy that, you know, with the cows behind him. And it's just, it was so about people. So it's really interesting. I was just thinking about this. I just tweeted something out. Everyone, I air in Concord, New Hampshire, so obviously I pay attention to what's happening with my state politics. And Chris Sununu, the Republican, has outraised both the two Democrats put together. Okay, so we have Dan Feltes and Andrew Walensky both running in the primary. The primary is until September. And he has outraised them 3 or 10-fold. Okay, but here's what's interesting. How many contributors does he have? 577.
Ooh.
So let me just tell you, everyone. So the two Democrats, they have thousands. They have thousands. So you got to ask the question, who's Chris Sununu going to represent? Is he going to represent you? Or is he going to represent Bank of America? Is he going to represent you, or is he going to represent some pharmaceutical company? I mean, when you realize big checks with commas in them is where he got all the money. And I want to also remind everyone else, and this is also true, Stefan, which is why Chris Sununu is stupid. What we know about this pandemic is that we just saw the numbers coming out, that the numbers spiked in unemployment, by the way. Okay, the new numbers just came out and the numbers went up. The problem is that during this pandemic, the rich have made out like bandits. We've created more billionaires. Wall Street has done unbelievably well as people have lost their livelihoods, have lost their jobs, are losing their houses, are getting evicted from their homes. And so the fact that he's only got 570 contributors tells you everything about who he cares about and who he's connecting with. And it isn't the people that are living on the edge. And that, I think, is an important story to tell. And that's what the Democratic Convention was all about. It was all about how we are living and not how the wealthy are living.
Absolutely. And when you look at polls, you know that the credibility, the trust and approval rating of Congress and of the government is at as low as it's ever been. People don't trust politicians, Arnie. And the conventions in the past have been mostly about politicians, as you said. This convention is about ordinary individuals, and that's a huge difference.
Right. And actually, every storyline they've told, they didn't have to tell the story of Michelle. They didn't have to tell the story of Obama. But they did tell the story of Jill Biden. I have to tell you, you kind of loved it. This beautiful 26-year-old gets invited out on a date, you know, with Joe Biden, an older man with two kids. And she's like, what the heck am I doing? And you kind of loved her story because you liked her. You liked her. And the idea of standing in an empty classroom was brilliant, because it spoke to parents, it spoke to teachers, it spoke to the economy, because we all suddenly realized that schools are more than schools. They're daycare centers. They prepare the future. That, you know, teaching is a challenge, because now every parent suddenly realizes what a teacher does with 25 kids in a class, and all you're doing it is with two at the table with your laptop. So in a lot of ways, Jill Biden's story wasn't the story of, you know, the vice president's wife.
Right.
It was a story of us, you know, and that was so interesting.
And the remarkable thing is that Jill Biden, when asked, said, I'm going to continue teaching if I'm the first lady. I'm going to go back and teach because that's what I love to do. And that's never happened before, apparently. There's never been a first lady in modern history, at least, who actually had a day job. So, you know.
At a day job. Exactly
usually,
right.
Usually they have to decide what kind of china they want to put out for the big banquet for the Chinese prime minister or president. She is going to be a great asset. People do look at the first lady and ask themselves, you know, what is her role going to be? How is she going to work with the president? And she apparently was responsible essentially for calming him down and saying to him, yes, you can run again.
Exactly.
So that's another nice story.
Well, again, what you get is it's so interesting to see the different teams. See, Bill and Hillary really were co-presidents. Both of them were very ambitious. Everything they did was about what they were going to get elected to. Then you see Michelle and Barack, and they have a very different relationship than Bill and Hillary. And now you're seeing Jill and Joe. And a lot of ways, these relationships really tell you more about not just the couple, but about the individual you're electing.
Right.
I mean, Hillary Clinton described Bill Clinton because they're both incredibly ambitious and would do whatever it would take to win. Yeah. And that's, I mean, Bill Clinton became a Republican. I mean, let's be honest. He was a Republican wet dream during the 1990s. Everything Newt Gingrich would ever imagine doing, Bill Clinton actually delivered. And Newt Gingrich had to, you know, grudgingly sort of say, I did want to repeal Glass-Steagall. I did want to do crime reform. I did want to do welfare reform. And it was a Democrat who did it. You know, and then in a lot of ways, Hillary Clinton built on that because she moved to New York and it was an IOU from Wall Street. But Barack and Michelle were very, very different in that way. And yet you get what you get with Jill, the fact that she's going back to teaching. She's going back to what the Democratic Party really wants to talk about, which is workers, which is people, which is, you know, this is about the struggle of figuring out how to survive, not only in a pandemic, but in a downed economy. So I want to just talk about something that I think is also interesting. Andrew Yang must be popping the champagne. And the reason why Andrew Yang must be popping the champagne is I saw a story that came out of Business Insider just this morning. Listen to this, Stefan. Germany is beginning a universal basic income trial with people getting $1,400 a month for 3 years. For 3 years. And I'm like, holy mackerel, this is incredible. And not only is it interesting, but the reason why Germany giving you $1,300 a month is huge compared to giving us $2,000 a month in the United States is they have universal health care. They have free college education. They have basically free pre-K. They have paid parental leave. They have, I mean, think about all the social safety nets they already have that we can't even imagine because we have to cut a check for. And on top of that safety net, they're saying, we're going to try this universal basic income of $1,300 a month. I hope we all take copious notes. And what I suggested to Andrew Yang is he needs to learn German because he has to go over there and like describe to us what's happening because he was really ahead of the curve. We thought he was crazy when he was talking about it. And yet look what Germany is actually talking about instituting.
Well, and it's extraordinary because, of course, Germany is also a premier example of a capitalist country. They are a market economy. They are very competitive. They believe in, you know, manufacturing. It's not a socialist
in
program.
Way.
What it is a smart program that educates people, keeps people off crime, off the streets. It underpins and strengthens their market economy. You know, and that's a lesson that Republicans should learn because Republicans mock these kinds of policies as being soft and weak and anti-capitalist and so on. It is remarkable.
Well, you know what also is remarkable? And let me just go back to those numbers I just told you about from CNBC where they saw a significant spike in unemployment. And why I think that that's surprising is the Republicans were going to the bank because when they saw that the numbers had dropped relatively significantly, more than they had anticipated, like last week or the week before, they were saying, see, that $600 a week extra in unemployment benefits was keeping people from going back to work.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? This is now the second or third week of people not receiving those additional unemployment benefits. And yet what happened? There is a spike in unemployment numbers. So guess what? They are not able to work. They are not finding jobs. They are getting pink slipped. It wasn't about the $600. Sure. It was about the nature of this economy and how we are on our way, not to a recession, but I think to a depression.
The reality is, of course, that the service sector of the United States, which is such a huge part of the economy, that means restaurants, bars, health centers, exercise clubs, hairdressers, stylists, they are having a very, very difficult time reopening in the face of the pandemic. Those are a lot of the jobs that, you know, were suspended and, as you said, are now basically disappearing. Because those sectors of the economy, I mean, in Ames, Iowa, my university town, where I will return reluctantly soon, the outbreak of more cases among college students and partying, people are now saying we should close all the bars. Well, yes, maybe, but that unemploys a hell of a lot of people. And so how do you bring those people back into consumption spending, and how do you retrain them for something else? Because I think the service economy, you know, the prediction is that this virus is going to linger along for a long time. It's going to be difficult to return to, you know, where we were, make America great again in 1950s style America. And so we need to rethink the economy as a whole. I hope Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have some ideas on and we'll roll those out on where we can go that will be a more robust economy.
And let me just say something else. So we've talked about this a little bit this week, and that is that, you know, will there be a vaccine? Do you trust the vaccine? All the anti-vaxxers, yada, yada, yada. The Harvard School of Public Health, the Chan School, has said that what might be at least initially an alternative, and maybe for the people who are anti-vaxxers an alternative, is the saliva test. You can take a test in your home every single day, like a pregnancy test, everyone. You get the answer in about 10 minutes. If everyone is able to get the saliva test, it would be the equivalent of a vaccine. It's very similar to that. So there are things, but I was just, it just occurred to me as you were talking about who can't return to work and the idea of the bars and the restaurant community. With schools making the decision, and I don't mean just college campuses, but I mean even public schools, whether they decide to go online or go every other day. So let's say they decide to go online, which is what Concord is doing, for example. Concord, New Hampshire is doing all online. They're not opening the schools. Do you know who's now getting unemployed? The custodians, the food workers, the cafeteria workers, the bus drivers. Because if you're not going to school, all those support staff, what do you do with them? Yeah. The teachers are still working. They're working round the clock now because they have to educate their own kids, plus they have to be online. But all the support staff that keep the universities going, that keep the public schools going, they're not necessary anymore. So the number of pink-slipped or temporarily laid-off people is going to be incredibly huge. And Donald Trump is cutting off his nose to spite his face. He wants the economy to come back. The economy is going to crater even more with each passing week because of this decision not to include the $600. And as we see more and more people losing access to the workforce because of the changing nature of how we determine college and work and everything else.
Well, that's true. The foolishness of not robustly investing and pushing for testing for all of the necessary equipment to be able to contain this thing and flatten it out and make sure that schools and other things could open now, which the Trump administration sort of said, well, we don't do that. You know, let the governors do it. Let the mayors do it. I'm not doing that. Is now coming back in a horrible way with paralysis of the economy. By the way, talking about vaccines, I just saw this. I'm very close to Massachusetts, and I get WBZ and all these channels and radio and stuff. They're now mandating vaccinations for everyone.
Wow. They're going to do it by law.
Giving a few exceptions for religion and for a couple of other medical reasons. Wow. But every kid up to a certain age, from small to a certain age, has to be vaccinated going into school and college.
Okay, so let me just say something. Then we have to trust the result. I mean, that's why I'm so angry at what Putin did. You know, Putin, by releasing, I mean, again, we're on this fast track where obviously everybody is working in a way that they've never worked before.
Yes.
But I understand the mandate, but you don't want to undermine government either, because we have to make sure that the science is respected and that we trust the result of the vaccine.
These are flu shots.
Oh, okay.
In Massachusetts.
Okay.
Flu shots.
Okay.
They've been around forever.
Okay.
Barely trusted.
Okay. No. I
didn't have a COVID virus vaccine yet, Arnie.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the governor and the state of Massachusetts will do with Putin's vaccine. I think what they're doing is they're calling up the Kremlin every day saying, how's Putin's daughter doing, the one that you gave the vaccine to? It's flu shots. Yes.
Well, listen. Since we're talking before we leave Putin, though, I want to make sure we talk a little bit about the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee came out with this report on Russia. And what I think is even more amazing is in that report, it exposes U.S. President's letters to Vladimir Putin. Okay, so not only did you get all these Republicans basically pointing to the connection between Trump and Putin and Russia, but they actually showed letters between these two. Unbelievable.
Love letters.
That's right. Love letters.
With perfumed love letters. But you know what? I think the impact of this has not hit yet.
Yes.
Because it is this Republican-controlled Senate, not the House of Representatives.
Yes, it's amazing.
And they did a deep investigation. Now, I know a lot of people are very skeptical of this. There are people who say, oh, this Russia thing is a hoax. And not only Republicans, but a lot of my friends who are Democrats are saying, oh, you know, the spies, the FBI, the CIA, they're always blaming everything on Russia. And it's a big hoax. But, you know, there has to be a grain of truth in a report that is this detailed and the result of so much research into the relationship between the Trump campaign, especially Paul Manafort. I mean, it was ridiculous. Paul Manafort was calling his contact with the Kremlin every single day.
So on that note, Stefan Schmidt, it has been a pleasure. Please stay healthy. Please stay safe. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. And we will schmooze on Monday. Ciao, everyone. Enjoy Thursday night, because we're not going to get the chance to talk about it. Bye-bye. Change.